Ya lo hace. Pierna derecha, directo al arco. ¡Golazo! ¡Golazo!
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Tuesday, February 12th, 2019. I'm Kevin Larame, joined by Dwayne Mullins. As always, the Pozuelo transfer saga keeps getting more interesting day by day, and to give us the latest update on the Pozuelo situation, we have Kaan Bayazit, a soccer reporter from Belgium, based in Belgium. How you doing, Kaan, this morning?
Good afternoon, Kevin. Good afternoon, Dwayne. I hope you're both doing well.
Well, we are. I'm following a lot of drama in Belgium lately. You're a little closer to the action. I understand there was a statement this morning. We've seen a little bit of it on Twitter from the player himself. Can you just give us a quick update on that before we get into the meat of this?
Yeah, so I'm actually just posting that, the exact translation of the entire statement on Twitter just right now. As Kevin told me, there was some Google translating going on already from the American soccer journalists, but I'll just put out an exact translation in about a minute or two. But basically what it boils down to is Racing Genk made a statement yesterday saying that, look, we had an agreement with Pozuelo in January. There were offers in January from Al Ahly, who were offering Pozuelo 3 million euros a year. He ended up turning that down in favor to stay with Genk to fight for the title, because I'm not sure if the listeners are aware, but they're at the top of the table right now. They're, I believe, 11 points clear on reigning champions Club Brugge. But the thing is, in Belgium, there's a playoff system. So in about five match days, the regular competition will be finished and the top six will play a playoff. Now, if Genk say they go into that playoff with a 15-point lead, it'll be cut in half. So that'll become a 7-point lead. But then if they finish on equal points, they will have the advantage because they take that half point, basically. But that still makes it so that Genk haven't won the title yet. You know, if you want to say they won the title, they probably have to go into that playoff with a 20-point lead or something. And then you can probably safely say, look, 10 points, they're not going to give that away. And they're not likely going to give away an 11 or a 12-point lead or going into the playoffs with 6 points, whatever. But still, I mean, Pozuelo is an instrumental key player for them. He is very important for their system. And they don't have a replacement. The transfer window has shut. So Genk can't replace him anymore at this point because the transfer window shut at the 31st of January. And the situation is basically that because he didn't leave in January, Genk were perfectly willing to let him go in January if his 8 million release clause was met. But that didn't happen in January, and then they ended up making an agreement, or so Genk says, a legally binding agreement, according to them, that would see him stay at the club until June 14th, and then he would, you know, after the season, be sold in the summer transfer window. But now, this morning, Alejandro Pozuelo sent in a statement to one of the biggest newspapers in Belgium called Het Laatste Nieuws, which just means the latest news, stating that I never signed such an agreement. I did agree to stay at the club, but I never actually put pen to paper. So he basically contradicts Genk's statement from yesterday, and also goes on saying that if push comes to shove, I'll be forced to take legal action against the club, and I will do so because I feel that they're treating me unfairly, basically, to make a long story short.
Okay, this is what I don't understand from a Genk perspective. Why would they want to force him to stay at this point? Do you not believe, and you can tell me what you know of the player and whether he's this type of guy, do you not believe that forcing this player to stay, taking money out of his pocket in his mind, won't actually just create a toxic environment that might actually make it more difficult for them to be successful in that playoff?
Look, I think that's what it's going to come down to in the end. But I understand Ging's perspective perfectly. I mean, look, he's arguably their most important player. They're about to win their fourth championship if everything continues to go well. That means Champions League. That means Champions League money. That's a very big thing for them. They can't, with a straight face, go and say to their fans right now, look, we're selling our best player outside of the transfer window right when we're about to clinch the title, hopefully. But there's still those playoffs, those very tough playoffs coming, which will be 10 games against the five other teams from the top six. So those will be 10 intense games. And they're going to need to be at full strength. So for Genk, it's a very difficult position that Pozzuolo was putting them in. It's honestly, if you ask me, if Toronto wanted him, they should have come 2 weeks earlier. This is putting Genk in a very bad position. I don't really know what you expect from them to do. They can't just roll over and say, oh, you know what, take our best player out of our hands just like this. When there was whether it was a legally binding or a verbal agreement in January, they believe they have an agreement in place with Pozzuolo that he agreed to stay until the 14th of June. So I completely understand that they want to at least try to convince the player to stay until the 14th of June. I mean, and you know what? For Pozzuolo taking money out of his pocket, I don't buy that. It's not like his market value is suddenly going to drop by winning the league with an underdog. On the contrary, you know, his market value should only increase. Now, the only thing you can say is, look, what if he gets injured? Okay, that's you can think like that, but then you have to sell every player at the first offer that comes along. That's your mindset.
We're talking about Pozzuolo here, Alejandro Pozzuolo. Can you describe to us a bit his playing style and his value to a club like Genk, and to a value that he could bring to Toronto, hypothetically?
Well, Pozzuolo is really a playmaker, maybe a little bit of an old-school playmaker. You guys know Victor Vázquez, of course. You could liken him a little bit to Vázquez. He's very technical. But in the past, he used to have some stamina issues, like Vázquez did as well. But he has really overcome that, and he's improved a lot as a player. But he's always been a player that's, I think, throughout his career has been plagued a little bit with little injuries, a little here and there. And it really took him a long time before he became the player that he is today. I believe he's like 28 years old already or something like that. I guess he's 26, because Genk's core team is really young, actually. So he's probably around 26, if I'm not mistaken. So he's at that stage. He's peaking right now. He's been a player that's kind of gone under the radar in Spain for many years. He's been playing for Genk now for quite a while, since 2017. But I believe that's his second stint already at the club, if I'm not mistaken. And he's just a really classy player. He can perfectly play with both feet. Like, it's really difficult to tell. Is he left-footed? Is he right-footed? Like, it's really difficult to tell if you don't know. He himself, I believe, he says he's originally right-footed, but he's a great technician.
Now, with this being said, what is the reaction of Belgium Genk fan, or the Genk media as well, on this situation?
Well, yeah, the media, I think, have a similar reaction as I do. He's putting the club in a very difficult position right now. I think it's not fair towards the Genk fans, and it's not really fair towards the club. Yes, you have an 8 million release clause. That's fine. But then you should have taken an offer in January. Now you're putting the club in a very difficult position. And you know what the thing is as well? There's this whole huge scandal that broke out a couple of months ago here in Belgium with player agents. It's a long story, but basically the media right now in Belgium are kind of reacting. It's an agent that's smelling money again. And when you read the statement that was sent out as well today by Pozzuolo, for the trained eye, you can see that that's written by the agency, not by the player himself. Very specific lingo that you can recognize. And it's about money, really. The player this agency have convinced him apparently of the fact that, look, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You're not going to ever get this type of money offer again, which I don't buy, because like I said, look, what's going to happen if he wins the league with Genk? Is his market value suddenly going to drop? Okay, fine, you know, Toronto will have to get another replacement for Giovinco, but come on, there's other clubs out there that are going to be interested in Pozzuolo. Whether it's Toronto or whether it's another Arab club or a Chinese club or maybe a very nice club in Europe, you don't know. But there's going to be offers in the summer with the performance he's put in. It's just impossible for that not to happen. He's just been so great this season. There's going to be massive interest.
Khan is also an expert on Turkish football, so we'll move the conversation there in a minute. But before we do that, let's wrap this conversation up with just the speculation question. Where do you think this is headed? In a week from now, do you think that he will be a Toronto player, or do you think he will still be in Belgium?
Well, it's like you said already, Dwayne. I mean, this is kind of a situation where it's just a game of chicken right now at this point, and who's going to flinch first? And I think that it's going to be the club, because Genk, look, they can play hardball for a while there, but ultimately, what are they going to do? If they force him to stay, there's going to be long legal procedures and all that kind of stuff. He's not going to be focused, even though he said in a statement, I will give it my all until the final day I play for Racing Genk, because I owe that to the fans. He did literally end his statement with that. But, you know, stuff like this, it's going to play in his head regardless whether it's conscious or subconscious. It's going to affect his performance. So I think ultimately Genk are just going to have to accept and accept that offer. But we saw a similar situation in Turkey this past January, where a young player, Ozan Kabak from Galatasaray, had a 7.5 million release clause in his contract, and he was going to leave during the January transfer window, but the club ended up convincing him to stay until the end of the season. And then, like a week later, Stuttgart actually came in with a higher offer, an 11 million euro offer, rather than the 7.5 million release clause. I think might be headed that way, where Toronto might say, look, we're going to give you 10 or 11 million so that the club can say to their fans, at least, look, okay, he had an 8 million release clause. It was a very difficult situation, but we got a little bit more out of it. I think that's going to be the best case scenario solution. I think that's where Toronto, if I were Toronto, that's what I would do. Offer them a little bit more to give them a win, if you know what I mean. So they can present that to their fans.
Fair enough. I'll let Kevin move it to Turkey, but one more question on the Belgian League. You did mention that this is, for those that know, that follow it at all, know that this is not among the traditional powers in Belgium. This would be an upset championship win. I think you had said it was their fourth championship. Just spell out how big of a story that is, how they managed to get there, and what it would mean in context for a club like this to win a title.
Genk are basically a fusion club that were created in 1990 or 1989, if I'm somewhere around those parts. They were basically two clubs, Waterschei and Winterslag, who were mining clubs for local coal mining plants, and those plants created clubs, and those ended up going together. We created Racing Genk. Genk is a big city in Limburg in Belgium, which is one of the states, provinces we call it, but it's like a state in comparable to states in America. And I don't know if Canada has states or provinces, but
we have provinces. We have provinces, yeah.
Ah, okay, then you'll be familiar with that. But they're the biggest club basically in that province. And they were founded in 1990. They won their first title in 1999, so only 9 years after they were founded. And then they won their second title in 2002, and then their third title in 2010. And that team had a lot of big stars that you will certainly know, because I listened to your last podcast. Kevin De Bruyne, Thibaut Courtois, were both in that squad. I think Christian Benteke might have been in it, but I'm not sure. I think he was gone already at that point. But basically, they had a really great generation then of players that have now, lots of them have made great careers in the top five leagues in Europe. And you know what? This team right now, it's a really young team. It's an extremely young team. They only have one player that's older than 26, I believe, in their starting 11, except for the goalkeeper Vukovic, who's 33 years old. But all the other players are like around 21, 22, 23 years old. It's an extremely young team. My personal favorite club, Besiktas, played them in Europe as well this season, and we got absolutely smacked around in that home game we played against them. They're a fantastic team. They play some amazing football, really quick on the counter, but also great in possession. They can do it all, make the game, and hit teams on the counter. They have a young upcoming coach, Philippe Clement, who used to play for Club Bruges, who was their captain as well. But he's a very special character, because nobody really expected him to play the kind of football that he has his team play right now, because he was kind of like a boring player, so to speak, never really said too much to the media and all that. But now his character is coming through very well. He's showing, you know, that little bit of a sense of humor and all that kind of stuff. But tactically, he's been absolutely brilliant, and they have a great team. There's a couple of players that you'll definitely be hearing of in the coming years, like Mele, who's one of their fullbacks, is a very young player. He's great. Joachim Mele is his name. I believe he's Danish. I'm not 100% sure. He's Danish or Swedish or something. And then they have, of course, Ruslan Malinovsky. He's one of the older players in the team with 26. He's a really good central midfielder from Ukraine. Then they have Leandro Trossard on the wing, another Belgian guy. He's 25. He's also one of the older players on the team, but he's also a great player, scores a lot of goals. And they have a young striker that's banging them in left and right now as well, up top, called Samata. And then, of course, Alejandro Pozuelo, who's a key player as well. So, but those are the main players, really, that I just mentioned. And I think all of them have really big futures ahead of them. Mele is probably the biggest talent. He probably has the highest ceiling. But it's going to, whether he can stay healthy or not, I think he has had a few small injuries. But he's like 22 years old, so he could be in the Premier League real soon.
You mentioned your favorite club a couple minutes ago, Besiktas, and I'm going to move the discussion to the Turkish League. It's a surprising last couple of years, at least for an outsider like me. When I usually think about the Turkish League, I think about three big clubs, of course, Fenerbahce, Besiktas, and Galatasaray. But when I look at the table right now, the top team with 6 points ahead of Galatasaray in first place is the fourth club of Istanbul that's been taking over the last couple of years. Başakşehir is now the leader in the league. What can you tell us about their season so far, and how do they match up with Besiktas? Because we have to, you know, we've talked about this before, but Besiktas is a bit a favorite team for Canadians soccer fan because of Atiba Hutchinson, obviously, but as well because of Kyle Larin. So what can you tell us about Başakşehir, and what can you tell us about Besiktas this year so far, too?
First and foremost, about Başakşehir, let's start with the league leaders. They're a very curious club, very controversial club, actually, because they're kind of a government operated club. They have a lot of money that has no clear point of origin. They have an average attendance of around 2,600, which is
wow, that's not
very small.
Yeah,
it's
that's
like
terrible.
Less than 3,000 fans in their home games. I mean, literally, if they play, like on the weekend, they played Erzurumspor. And they were leading 1-0, Başakşehir were. And when Erzurumspor scored, the away fans just completely dominated the sound in the stadium, because the away section was just that much noisier. And I mean, when we think Turkish football, we think of very fanatical fans. But that's definitely not the case here. It's an artificial club. I always call them an artificial club because that's what they are. But let's put that aside for the moment and all the political involvement and all that. Let's put that aside for a moment and talk about the team. The team itself, they have a really capable coach, Abdullah Avci, who's been at the club for a very long time. He had a little stint at the national team in between his two stints at the club. But he's a tactically capable coach, and he really built this team. In the past, he was always known as the Başakşehir team, when they were still called Istanbul Büyükşehir Belediyespor. They were known as a very stubborn defensive collective that were very dangerous on the counter, because they had a really good defensive organization, but they didn't have the quality, so to speak, and they had some quick players on the wings, and so they hit the big teams on the counter. But what they always did, they were like the really tough opponent for Beşiktaş, Galatasaray, and Fenerbahçe because of that style. But they couldn't really get it done against the smaller teams in the league, because when they were given the ball, they didn't know what to do with it. But in recent years, they've been building a team that does know what to do with the ball. They have a lot of big names that some of you may recognize. Emre Belözoğlu, ex-Newcastle United, ex-Inter Milan. He's their captain. He's 38 years old already, but he's still good. Of course, Emmanuel Adebayor, ex-Arsenal, ex-Manchester City. Robinho, ex-Real Madrid. Dembaba is there now too, ex-Chelsea, and ex-Besiktas too. Who else am I missing? There's several big names, really, but their biggest star is someone they created themselves, and that's Edin Visca. He's a Bosnian international. He's 28 years old already now. But he's really their best player. But they have a really old team. I think an average age of around 30 years old or something. I mean, their starters are almost all in their 30s, except for Edin Visca and Irfan Jankavici and I guess Mahmut Tekdemir. So like three or four players are under 30, but the rest are all well into their 30s. And they play still a very well-organized piece of football. They are really difficult to score against. They're well-organized, dangerous on set pieces as well, with their defender Ipriano occasionally getting on the score sheet, really good and dangerous in the air. And then, yeah, they've developed their attacking game in the last couple of years as well. Now, they've competed for the title the previous two seasons, but they have choked really in both those seasons, because yes, they have a lot of experience in terms of their players, but as a club, they really don't. In the 2016-17 season, they were really in a lost position when they were facing Beşiktaş. That was their last chance. It was like on match day, I want to say 29 or something, and Beşiktaş were like 7 points ahead at that point. So had they won, they would have been champions, because Beşiktaş were their only challengers. But then they were in an underdog position, and Beşiktaş really surprised Beşiktaş in the first half, and they took a 3-0 lead in the first half, and completely surprised. That took them by surprise. And the match ended up being 3-1, but then they were being put back into a very favorable position in the title race heading into those final few weeks. But they had that really big win against Beşiktaş, but then they couldn't follow it up and choked in the next weeks. And then last season, really, Beşiktaş completely dropped the ball in the league. They had, of course, an amazing Champions League campaign, finished unbeaten in the group stages, winning the group, and then going out against Bayern Munich in the last 16. So Beşiktaş had a great European campaign, but in the league, they were really disappointing. And it was really Beşiktaş to win, you'd think. They were probably the best. They probably had the best squad. Galatasaray had a really good starting 11, because they had splashed big in on the transfer market that summer, with spending roughly 45, 50 million euros, which is crazy in Turkey. I think that was the highest amount of transfer fee ever spent by a Turkish club in a single window, I believe. But they had a really good starting 11, but not a good squad there. Like, their bench was really weak. And Beşiktaş had a good bench and a good squad, so they had arguably the better squad. But again, when staring at the possibility of becoming a champion, they choked again. And then now this season, the rivals have really let things go a little bit. I mean, Fenerbahce at the bottom of the table are fighting relegation. Beşiktaş only got 26 points in the first half of the season, which is in 17 games is really disappointing. Galatasaray got, I believe, 29 points or so, which is equally disappointing, I'd say. And then Başakşehir got 35 points, and that's not impressive by any stretch of the imagination, but it was good enough because the rest were so bad. And I would really say that in the first half of the season, they weren't all that impressive or relentless, but then they started the second half of the season really well until this past match day where they drew at home against Erzurumspor. Yeah, and now they still have a pretty good lead on Galatasaray, 6 points, and 9 points on Beşiktaş. The thing with them is, I think if they go into those final few weeks with a good lead, then they're going to win the title. But if they're going to go into those final few weeks with like a 4-point lead or something like that, I can't see them win it because they've proven it the previous two seasons that they can't cope under pressure, really, when they're in a position of being a favorite.
Can Bayazit, soccer reporter from Belgium. Thank you very much for your time today. And just before we say goodbye, how's our boys Kyle Larin and Atiba doing in Beşiktaş?
Well, Atiba, he's been at the club now for over 6 years. He just turned 36 years old. And I can tell you, when he first came, I don't think anyone thought that he was going to be a legend of the club in 6 years' time, and would still be playing for the club in 6 years' time. He isn't as undisputable as he has been the previous 4-5 years. Really, he's had some injury issues at the end of the 2016-17 season. He missed almost the entire end of that season, and last season again he had some injury woes. And that carried over into this season. At the start of the season, he didn't play much, but then he gradually got into the team again. But it's been kind of, he's been interchanged a little bit with Gary Medel, something that, in my opinion, doesn't really work because Medel doesn't have the same qualities as Atiba has as a distributor of the ball. But then the other day, this past weekend, I think I swear, in 6 years of seeing this man play every match, he completely surprised me. And I just by the fact of how well he played going forward, because I think we all kind of know Atiba, especially at Beşiktaş, though, as a player that plays a lot of lateral passes and kind of builds insecurity into the midfield. He's kind of the holding midfielder for Beşiktaş, at least. But on the weekend, Dorukhan Tokuz is a young player that played next to him, a 22-year-old who's been stellar this season. He really played a selfless match, and Atiba was playing more in almost a playmaker sort of role, where he played a lot of passes forward and started a lot of attacks. And I think it was probably one of his best matches I've ever seen him play, which really took me by surprise. He's absolutely a legend of the club. I think this might be his last season. But I don't know. He's been going on this 1-year extension deal for the last 3 years or so now. So the way he played on the weekend, he can definitely still go. But then we have seen a decline in his performance overall the last 2 years. Because, I mean, yeah, age ultimately catches up to everyone. I think the case with Atiba is he's not a 45 to 50 match a year player anymore. I think you need to use him more sparingly, but if you do, I think you can still definitely get some good games out of him. As for Kyle Larin, he really didn't get much of a chance last season until the last few weeks, and then he kind of impressed us all with some goals in a very few amount of minutes. I think he scored like 4 goals in, let's say, 150 or 200 minutes or something. And then we went into the season thinking that he could definitely be a valuable number two, but he kind of completely fell off the wagon, scored a bunch of goals against Tórshavn, which is a team from the Faroe Islands, but that's pretty much it. He couldn't get the job done against players who don't have a day job as a mailman or a policeman or whatever. he's been a pretty big disappointment this season. He's on a pretty big contract as well, and I'm of the opinion that he needs to get loaned out. I think if he would be loaned to a Dutch club or something, he could really build up his confidence and all that. But he needs to, he's not a Besiktas level player. I don't think he ever will be. He just doesn't have that that special thing needed to be really good at that level. I think he can be a decent 12 to 15 goal a season Eredivisie striker for a mid-table side in Europe. But he's never going to be a top striker for in a top five league for sure.
You can follow Khan on Twitter at Razerian. That's at RAZZERIAN. Thank you very much for your time today, Khan.
It's a pleasure, guys. If you ever need any information on the Turkish League or on Belgium, just let me know and I'll come on again.
We will for sure, and we will be right back after this short break.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
So it's interesting to get the latest update on the Pozuelo situation, but what really caught my attention in that 30-minute interview, Dwayne, is two things I want to touch on, and then we'll continue for the rest of the show. First of all, Larin not being a Besiktas player, I guess we actually said it like a couple of years ago that we were unsure of how this would happen, but it'll be interesting to see where Larin ends up, and I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up back in Major League Soccer before we know it. Basically, Kyle Larin, the Canadian Juan Agudelo.
There has been people that have suggested to me that he might even end up back in Toronto, and that might be what they have in mind with their allocation, because he would need to go back through the allocation order because he was sold. For those that don't know, the allocation refers to two types of players, either U.S. men's national team regulars, not Canadian men's national team regulars, but U.S. men's national team regulars, or players that were in MLS and sold away from MLS to come back into the league. You have to go through the allocation order. TFC has the top allocation order still. And there has been some people that have speculated to me that it might be about bringing Larin back. Now, take that with a grain of salt. I have heard it from a few different people, but I've always been reluctant to embrace it as a true rumor, because I know that, well, when Kyle was coming into the league, his relation with TFC was not the best. There's a bit of a rivalry between Seguin and TFC, and that played into it. But it's a rivalry between Sigma and TFC on the development side of things.
Yeah, I was going to say on the academy level or at the development level.
Yeah, because until this year, they really didn't have a chance to play each other in a one-on-one action. There is the opportunity for those that don't know that are maybe listening to outside Canada.
Forge FC versus TFC is basically Sigma versus academy.
Yes, precisely. And Coach Bobby is the guy that set he has a very long Greek law for last name, so we just call him Coach Bobby, that is essentially running that program. So, yeah, so up until now, that rivalry's been real. And look, Kyle Larin's not going to come back to Forge. He's simply not. That's not the level that he's at. So, yes, he will. There is that suggestion out there. But putting TFC aside, and they do have the first allocation order, so there is some power there, and there is some level of speculation that you could take to that. I think MLS is a natural place for him to come back to, because he did excel in this league. It was disappointing that he hasn't really been able to get a foothold in Turkey, but Kyle is a bit of an enigma. And I was just looking at his stats today. He has 4 goals this year. 3 were in the Europa League, as Khan mentioned, though, against very weak opposition. He did manage to score in the Turkish League a couple weeks ago. Ironically, it was during Alphonso Davies' debut for him on the bench anyway.
Yeah, because I saw that on my Twitter feed. I was like, oh, Larin Discord. Wow, what a day for Canada. And, you know, we only see when he scores. Obviously, Besiktas doesn't do, like, Twitter posted, oh, Larin missed a sitter again. Like, no, but we know that that's usually what happens with Larin too. But no, it's interesting.
Yeah, look, he's in a bit of an enigma, but he's in 95. And when we're talking about young players, we're talking about 2000s now, right? Like, that's, you know, Alphonso Davies is a 2000. I'm referring to his year of birth. So that's what a young player is. It 98, 99, but at 95 is not a young player anymore. This is Kyle Larin at his level. I mean, he was good enough to get that contract. Whether he could come back in MLS and be as successful as he was for Orlando in the early years is, you know, if the confidence isn't shot, then maybe. You know, the Dutch league's interesting too. Maybe he bangs around at that mid-level. But from a Canadian perspective, I think what's wonderful, not wonderful for Kyle, but obviously there was a time not too long ago where we all looked at Larin as the great white hope, right? Yeah, like he was the guy that we were looking at to save Canada as a goal scorer, but it never really worked out on the national team level, as a lot of national team fans are aware of. He doesn't score a ton for the national team and has been frustrating at times. But we don't need him to be any more than a depth player at this point anymore. So that's kind of a relief that way. There seems to be a lot more. Well, you look at we didn't have a chance to talk with Jonathan David, who is at Gent, not Genk, yeah. in Belgium.
The blue one, not the red and black one. So there's two teams.
Yes, and like those guys like that are coming up. If Kyle Larin comes back and has a decent MLS career, he could absolutely play a role in the national team moving forward. But I think that we can now sort of judge based on his age and where he's at, sort of what he is. And what he is a big body that I think can play a big role against smaller teams. And I think Kyle Larin can be very useful in World Cup qualifying and playing the Caribbean teams. You need a banger in there. You need a guy that can be physical, that can get ugly, sloppy goals in ugly, sloppy situations through power. And he has that ability. So I do think he has a role in the national team. I just don't know if he's ever going to be a superstar that we might have hoped he would. And the other thing I was thinking of, and we'll move from this after this, Kevin, is that when I was looking at that, I'm thinking, it's a damn shame. And Sigmund does a wonderful job, but it's still a damn shame that he had to go through UConn. You know, had he been in a professional environment when he was 18, like Jonathan David, I think that he had so much immense talent that he could have really been successful. But he came out at 22. And by that time, it's done. And that's why we really need to move away from the college system. And I think everyone understands that now, but we just do.
No, I agree with you a lot. And we'll see what the future has in store for Kyle Larin. Now, the other interesting aspect in this interview is when Kaan was talking about the league leaders in Turkey right now, Başakşehir. And we don't usually hear about this, but it's a very heavy politically charged team, where it's a team that's owned by the government, which is owned by Erdogan, the president of Turkey. And he's literally, that's his baby. And they do have unfair advantages versus other teams. And the fact that they're... The best way to put this into perspective is to put it in a situation that we would understand here. So how about if Donald Trump was owner of DC United and using his political connections to make sure this club gets the players they want, the advantages they want, more allocation than other team, that's very MLS, and stuff like that, and the team doesn't draw anyone. This is basically what is Besiktas here in Turkey in MLS terms, and I think that's fascinating. We don't realize sometimes the extent of the power of football for good, for propaganda, and for bad. There's always different options there. And it's kind of fascinating in a way.
Well, read the balls around. There has never been a time in the history of the game that the sport has not been used for political gains and business gains, too. I mean, there's Juve is essentially, you know, built off the back of the industry in Turin. There's lots of examples that half the German system is built off of industry back, even though it's ironically they're so anti it now. It's interesting. You know, you have teams that are essentially Volkswagen farm teams, right? Like this is the world how it works politically. Real Madrid had big ties to Franco, the fascist dictator from the 30s, right? This is something that a lot of people still to this day, if you go to Madrid, you talk to Atleti fans, one of the reasons they're Athletic fans is because they're resisting, you know, what happened in the past. What happened to their grandparents in the past, right? Like, this stuff doesn't go away. You know, in terms of the Turkish situation, you are talking about a, you know, Adebayor's team here. So that tells you a little bit of the type of players that would be attracted to going to play in that environment. They are mercenaries. But as I said today on Twitter, mercenaries are a reality of 90% of the world, unless you are in the, you know, top 20 clubs in the world, you are attracting people that are coming primarily for financial reasons on their own motivations. And that's the essence, to tie this into the original story today, that's the essence of what we're seeing with Pozzella.
And here's a deep, deep thought for you. Aren't we all mercenaries? Aren't we all doing work or doing something for an exchange of payment? Doesn't that make us all a bit of a mercenary in a way? Like, well, literally, sure. from nurses to business owner, well, business workers, to even us. Like, we're kind of mercenaries in different scale, but, you know.
A little bit of a different scale, yeah. No, when you're talking about Pozzella, I mean, someone just said, oh, it shows great leadership. He wants to leave just for money. And it's like, I just pointed out to them just a few seconds ago, well, you're not just talking about a little bit of money here. You're talking about, like, life-changing money that this guy has placed in front of him. He's making about 800,000 right now. It's good money. Let's not dismiss that. But they're offering him three or four times that.
$800,000 is good money that if you do it a few years in your life, then the rest of your life you still need to work, but you'll be at ease and you don't have the worry of having the rent coming every month. Making a few million dollars a year is enough to set you up for life.
We're talking about kids up for life.
Yeah, we're talking about 40, 50 years of comfort, of a table filled with food, of a freezer filled up to the brink, of your guy works for the bank calling you and saying, "Hi, sir, everything's going well. The interests are piling up on your account, and we're going to make money, and your children are going to be set for life, and their children might be okay to have free education because of this." This is life-changing money, and sometimes we see those numbers, we see the decision, and we take the moral high ground because we're not in that situation, so it's easy for us to be like, oh, he's just doing it for the money. Wouldn't you? Wouldn't you do it for the money, too? Come on, be realistic here.
Well, yeah, no, I think that as fans, obviously we're fans we emotionally attach to certain teams out there, and we sort of lose perspective sometimes on why these players are coming in, and we want them to be something they can't be in many, many cases. I mean, no one grew up in Spain dreaming of playing for Toronto FC. That's be blunt here. No one outside of, you know, we're in the first generation where there are players that dreamed of playing for MLS teams, but they're American or Canadian players, right?
I was going to say, no one really dreamed of playing for TFC, but that's my opinion. We'll continue.
Yeah. Well, you know, like young people from the Toronto region might have, but it's a hyper local thing, right? But there, those young players that dreamed of playing for the Impact, let's say, to take that, take it away from any partisanship.
Yeah, those people 20 that, guys, you know, those 20 guys are cool. Anyways,
continue. Yeah, well, they dreamed of that, but they're also dreamed of playing for Arsenal, you know, or whoever. So obviously, you're going to go to where you're going to feel the most fulfilled in every way, including monetarily. And as I said again, not to point at my Twitter feed constantly, but as I said again today too, MLS is currently at a new part of its development. They used to attract 34-year-old mercenaries, and we didn't have to worry about what happened to the 34-year-old mercenary because they were coming in as a big name. They were selling some strips. They were, you know, setting up camps, they were doing whatever, and they were retiring after they were done that contract. They didn't have another contract in them. They were 34 when they came. They were at the final stage of their career. Now they're able to attract 27-year-old mercenaries. They're still mercenaries because they're coming for the money. They're coming primarily for financial security. You know, they're going to try and win when they're over here because they're all competitors, and athletes, you know, want to win when they're on the pitch. But by and large, their motivation for the move to a specific place is what's going to be best for them and the best situation for them for a multitude of reasons, not just financial. You look at Simon coming to Montreal for the benefit of his child. That's still a benefit that he's looking at that's beyond the field, right?
Which is the same reason why he's coming to Toronto. Let's be honest here. But yeah,
it's a positive thing in that particular case, but it's all part of those benefits. They aren't coming for purely sporting reasons is what I'm saying. In this particular case, you're going to have to deal with stuff like this. And you look at, you know, Pozzella right now and what's happening, and you can flash forward ahead 3 or 4 years and imagine the same thing happening to TFC because they just went through it with Giovinco.
Yeah.
But that's the reality, and they're going to have to adjust. And this is, I think, the lesson that TFC is learning right now. They had this as a potential target, but I think that they thought that maybe this is a guy that they might be able to move on in the summer if their season wasn't going great and they wanted to move away from you know, one of their DPs. But then they were forced into it quickly. And I think that what they've learned, hopefully they've learned, is to anticipate this a little bit more, because these guys don't think the same way that a North American sports star thinks. A North American sports star is closer to Josie, although Josie's kind of a weird in between right now. He's going to be fascinating to watch play out. But they think like, okay, this is my contract year. I've got to perform it on my next contract. That's not how a mercenary footballer thinks. They think, why don't I have security now? Like, I'm good enough to get a contract anywhere in the world because it's a world market.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to Janko. That's what's happened to Pizzella. You know, it's an abusive relationship across the board. We're just tying, like, we're doing the same thing to Genk, that
Al Hilal did to TFC.
See, exactly. And, you know, in this particular case, TFC fans are crossing the fingers, well, some of them, because a lot of people are saying we should move on at this point. And there's a fair argument for that, too, although I think that this player, from what I've known and what I've learned in the last week or so, would be a really impactful player in Major League Soccer.
I believe so, too, but continue.
Yeah, you have to make that decision at some point. But it's just, it's the cycle of life, really, man. And MLS is now at a different stage where they're able to go take players from the Belgian League. But someone else is always going to be bigger, or someone else is always going to be able to offer more money at a different stage of a player's career. And, you know, it's going to continue. This is the new evolution of MLS. Get used to it. This will not be the last time we have conversations about this, about transfer drama. It just happens to be one of the first ones where we're having this amount of drama.
The cycle of life. I just have an image from Lion King in my head now. Ta-da! Anyways, let's finish the show with two more topics. Dwayne, of course, we're going to give a little bit of time to the Champions League to finish the show, but I wanted to get your opinion. There's a new jersey. It's Jersey Week. I don't know if that's still a thing. But a lot
white
of
t-shirt.
We talked about the bland t-shirt. I'm talking about the FC Cincinnati one, which a lot of people, if you haven't seen it, it's of course blue and orange, and it's like kind of like stripes, but in a weird design. I don't know. A lot of people like it. I personally don't. I think it comes out straight of 2005 and that color scheme. I don't know. But what do you think? If Dwayne was a fashion blogger, what would Dwayne say about FC Cincinnati's kit?
If I was a fashion blogger, the world would be in trouble, for one. I let you know, the women in my life dress me for the most part.
it's Confidence Tuesday here on the Soccer Today.
There you go. Look, it's pretty dull, if you ask me. Not that inspired, but that's just the nature of it. And there was a really good post from our friend DJ from Cincinnati today about the reality, because he worked in that world of why they're so bland, because they have to be mass-produced. Nike has to mass-produce these, or it's Adidas. It's Adidas, right?
Adidas.
Whatever. Nike's Canada's kit, which is also boring, but they have to mass-produce them, so they can't really be that creative. And that's why we've always think for every, you know, every tournament, the great thing about it is you see a jersey and you immediately know what tournament you're looking at. You remember when they used to have the circle with the number in it? That's from 04, right? You know, we can
terrible, terrible World Cup jersey in 2006. That's a terrible one, but yeah, go.
Yeah, the days of like unique jerseys around the world are gone, unfortunately, because of mass production.
Except for the Canadian Premier League, which will have bespoke jerseys for every team, 14 different jerseys with 14 different inspiration. One day we'll
afford to, because they don't need to produce a million of them. They need to produce 1,000 of them, and that's the difference, right?
1,000? Sure. Even maybe less than that. We'll see. I guess they have to produce a lot, because a lot of teams are giving away. They're including one jersey in the season ticket package. But Halifax Wanderers, if you're listening, my address, I can DM you my address, no problem. I want that Wanderers kit. I have no idea what it looks like, but I want it.
I'll do something that a Torontonian's never supposed to admit. I've always thought the Impact have some of the nicest kits in the league, and I really like the new one with the blend of the black at the bottom.
I like it a lot too. I would have loved it even more if the stripe would have gone all the way through the bottom of the shirt. In the front, there's a little something in the bottom, and that like they disappear, the stripes. But it gives a different color scheme. And, you know, we often talk about blue and red and how those colors are overused in sports and especially in soccer. And there was what? I can count off the top of my head 4 or 5 teams in Major League Soccer that have blue as their dominant color. And now with the Impact using the black instead of the blue, it kind of separates you as well and gives you a different feel. And black is menacing. So we'll see if it actually helps the Impact have a bit more grinta, which was a word they were really high on last year. We'll see if this brings more grinta to the Impact in 2019.
Don't know with the bell on the strip, though, but we can leave that one well enough alone for a while.
The bell is there because of the North Star bell. The other supporters group are not necessarily happy about this in Montreal, but you know, a lot of people love the bell. It's identifiable, it's unique. A lot of people don't like the bell too, like hardcore supporters, like not necessarily ultras, but you know who I'm talking about here. They're not necessarily the best fan of the North Star bell because they see it as a convoluted sellout with the front office and the administration, even though it's supporters who paid for it. But it's something. But I do like that jersey, and I don't care about the bell.
My favorite bell story was after TFC shut them out at home, and GSP had been down there as the celebrity bell ringer.
GSP.
The GFC fans were all chanting, "Who are you? Who are you?" And it took us, he's very Franco, so it took him a second, I think, to figure out what we were chanting at him. And then when he heard it, he just looked at us and laughed and gave us a little clap because we all knew who it was.
For me, it was after the game, just pictures of him, like drawing of GSP. Sad GSP because he didn't ring the bell. You just see him with his head bowed down like, "Oh, I'm not impressed with your performance, Impact. I didn't get to ring the bell." Which, by the way, you know why I like the bell? Because one day I want to be the one who's invited to ring it. All right, Ali and 1642, I'm here. I'm always available to ring the bell.
There you go. I don't think I'll ever be invited to ring it, so it'll have to be you to represent the show.
Yeah, you won't. Anyways, it's good for you, because if you were next to the bell or behind the bell to see the match, you wouldn't see the match. So at least, you know, there's positive.
I'll let you all know in a secret. I rarely sit with TFC fans when I'm the Impact. I usually wear blue and just sit quietly in the crowd. So you can find me the next time in Montreal. At any rate.
All right, let's finish the show with this. Oh, that was supposed to be the Champions League bumper, but I guess I haven't used it in a long time. It's the Champions! Two games today. Man U, PSG. And we also have today as well Roma, Porto. Both matches at 3 p.m. Eastern on DAZN. What do you think about those two matchups in the first of 2 weeks of leg one of the round of 16?
I'm a hipster, so I'm going to watch Roma Porto. Don't worry about that. But no, look, to be serious, the United PSG game has become the most fascinating matchup in a long time for a lot of people because of the form that that United is on, and such. You know, I'll put my bias aside here for a second. The massive amount of success that club has had over the years in this competition, in all competitions, and now suddenly they seem to have their tail up again. And this has been probably 4 years since you could really say that about Manchester United, and now they legitimately have this up. And I would have to think that, you know, very quietly in the corridors of Old Trafford, they might be whispering that, you know, we're not going to win the league, but you never know. And PSG, meanwhile, Neymar might not play. There's injuries there. This is
Cavani,
not a club
might
that,
not play.
You know,
he was injured. Sorry.
Yeah, and there's so much the opposite history in this competition for PSG. They who have, you know, people, they have never fulfilled what people believe that they should do. And I think a part of that has to do with them not getting pushed in the league level, to be honest.
True.
That really does matter, that when you know, if you're not getting pushed week in, week out, how hard is it to suddenly raise your game 100 times in one day? So it's a fascinating matchup. And, you know, I do want to watch Porto Roma. I think that's interesting, the fact that one of those teams will be in the quarterfinals. But I will definitely be somewhere this afternoon where I can watch both of those at once. It's a good start to this to these four games. And this is, I believe, the round of 16 in the Champions League is the best football that we get over a condensed two-week period of time in any calendar year. It's incredible. And you always still have a few, you know, they're not minnows. Porto isn't a minnow, but in this context, they kind of are, right? So you still have a few stories like that. Usually you have the great clubs all still involved. Quarterfinals are amazing too, but the quarterfinals are usually big against big, so you don't necessarily have the narrative in the same way. So this is really my favorite part of the calendar every year in February.
And the quarterfinals, you start to see the final in front of you, and you start to play very defensively, and at least very conservatively. And I think the round of 16 is still, I don't want to say pure football, but the weight of the moment doesn't get into the way of the game in the round of 16. I'm not sure it's the same in the quarterfinals, semifinals, or final.
Yeah, similar argument I always make about the Europa League when it gets into the semifinals and finals is I always find that that's more entertaining to watch because you have teams that are, they want to win it, so they're going all out, but they don't fear losing it in the same way that they fear losing a semifinal in the Champions League. So you often will get some pretty damn good matchups in the Europa League semis and finals with two looser teams, and you can get some great football there too. But we'll worry about that on Thursday. Today, a lot of fun stuff, and Liverpool Bayern, that's the matchup I'm most looking forward to seeing. And not just because there's a potential that a Canadian might get in, although it's the slow potential based on how they've been using him recently.
They had it into the lineup. They had it into the roster. It's the first step. We'll see if he makes a step on the pitch. But the first step is to be added to the 23-man roster. And he has.
Yes, exactly. And that's a good sign for him moving forward. We haven't talked a lot about Afonso in the last recent days because he's kind of settled into what he's going to be. He's going to be a 10-minute player off the bench, which I think is kind of where we all thought he might be. I mean, some people might have thought he might not have even been that.
It's 10 minutes more than a lot of people were saying he was going to get per game. Because a lot of people thought he was going to be loaned out to somewhere in the Bundesliga 2 or in the boondocks somewhere. So there you go.
Yeah, precisely. There was no way in hell he was ever going to the B2, but you're right. There were people that thought that. He would have went to, would have been like lower, like to Bremen or something is where they would have loaned him, and where they still might loan him next year, and I wouldn't necessarily be opposed to that. I do like that he's trying to force his way into the lineup now, and there's going to be a major turnover there next year. I listen to so much Bayern media right now. I never really was I'm not a German fan in any real way. So it's fascinating to me to sort of catch up on this one, so it's a fun story for him. It's a good time of year to watch this game, though. It's what we're saying about this, and it starts today. Today with two very good games, two very interesting games on different levels. I don't know, Kevin, what are your thoughts on United, PSG, and Porto Roma?
Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I know I'm butchering his name every time I say it, so I'm going to say the Man United manager, the newly appointed one, is doing a great job with this club, and it does bring back some excitement to that game. Remember when the draw was made and we thought it was going to be Mourinho? We're like, oh man, Man United are going to get destroyed by PSG. That whole vibe has changed now. And Pogba's playing like Pogba should play, closer to the net and being dangerous. Rashford, Martial are both thriving under that new manager. So now it's going to be a great game tonight. And you're going to get to see a lot of young superstars facing each other. Mbappe versus Rashford and versus Martial, another great player. So it's going to be a fascinating game. Roma-Porto is going to be fun, of course. It's going to be an interesting matchup. Maybe a closer, tight matchup, not necessarily determined by the best players in the world like Mbappe might determine the PSG-Man U game, but it is two interesting games. Like, next week are very fascinating games too. But hey, Champions League back. I'm going to have my TV and my Chromecast tuned into the zone. And this afternoon at 3 p.m., don't look for me.
Fair enough. Look for me too. I'm on a snow day here. I don't know I guess maybe we'll end it with this. I'm watching another blizzard hit this city. I put the... Put the early weather for TFC's first home game out there. They are calling for minus 17 that night.
Oh, my. Next Tuesday for the Champions League?
They're in Panama next Tuesday. Okay, it's the 14-day schedule. So they're 2 weeks from today. There will be a home game at BMO Field. There was a lot of people for this CSA strategic plan announcement yesterday at BMO Field. There were a lot of reporters there. And by the way, we're not covering that because I've been to two of them. show me, don't tell me. If you're listening to CSA, show me, don't tell me. I don't care what your beautiful PowerPoint says. I'm sure it was well put together, but show me, don't tell me.
PowerPoint. Yeah. That's so 2010, Dwayne. Who does PowerPoints anymore?
You'd be surprised.
CSA does. This CSA does. Thanks a lot for listening today. Thanks to Khan again for his time earlier in the show. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute and myself at Kev Laramie. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Soccer Today. We'll touch on the Canadian Championship for sure this week, where the Canadian Premier League is getting its own spot, as well as the Caribbean potential league is getting a spot. There's a lot of other news as well, and we'll touch on them all this week, tomorrow, and Thursday will be the Two Solitude Soccer Podcast, which you can get for $2 a month, 50 cents a show, $2 a month on patreon.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. And as always, until tomorrow, for Dwayne Rollins, I'm Kevin Laramie, and have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.